as a result of our, or in the context of our discussion of the Rambam Pshita and Bias Kolchem, we're discussing the Reb Chaim's contribution to Bias Kolchem, etc., the implications and going beyond Reb Chaim, etc. So we were took the opportunity also to make some comments about the Rambam in light of all of that, the character of the Rambam, etc., and the fact that he relates to Kol HaTorah Kula, even dinim that aren't noheg bizman hazeh. What I was trying to explain was that there's overwhelming evidence, in my opinion, if you read the Rambam, continuously, and you chart and assess his contribution to understanding the sugyas, that this is not simply a comprehensive sefer of Pesach Halacha, but that it's also meant to be that, but that primarily it's the representation of the totality of Torah Shebaal Peh and Torah Shebichsav, of course, the totality of the world and the principles of the Halacha, and that it is structured in such a way, the purpose of it and the structure of it reflects this, to present conceptually Kol HaTorah Kula, and therefore this explains some of the expansiveness. It also explains some of the constrictions of what you might have anticipated in the Rambam. The expansion, of course, to Kol HaTorah Kula, and the lack of updating, like I said, even if you take the Tshuvas HaRambam, or if you take parallel works where they relate much more frequently to what's going on, and the Tshuvas HaRambam is just a great example, because these are issues that the Rambam himself is involved in, and yet he passes up on the opportunity to weigh in most cases. Obviously, it makes the situations where he does weigh in even more significant and requires more of an explanation. But the contrast to Poskim, who update and who apply what is their contemporary issues, is something which in the Rambam, just one more second, is absent, at least more absent than we would have expected. So that this also explains that his whole organizational structure, and I just wanted to add, because Elliot and I were discussing last time, if I didn't mention it then, that I was talking about specific situations where the Rambam arranges things or classifies them in a way which seems counterproductive or at least less effective with respect to the actual Pesach Halacha, but I'm suggesting that he does so for purposes of presenting Torah Shebaal Peh more conceptually accurately. So that kind of a decision, again, is a decision that you, again, if you can do all things at all times, certainly that would be the optimum editorial decision. But if when forced to choose between conceptual purity, let's say, and practical handbook efficiency, if in that circumstance you choose for conceptual integrity, then obviously that says a lot about your primary purpose, and the other things then become more secondary. So that it isn't just when the Rambam does this in a situation where it seems obvious where he's making that sacrifice, it also explains his reformulation and reorganization of Mishnayos and Gemaras, which he does typically. And again, often I think it can be demonstrated that he does this for purposes of, there might be other reasons too, but also for reasons of conceptual purity. So his, I've spoken in the past about Hilchos Nizkei Mamon, how the Rambam reorganized, and Hilchos Sukkah, and Hilchos Shabbos in some respects, that the Rambam, is focused on accomplishing the goal of representing Torah Shebaal Peh, not only in its totality, but again in its organizational, conceptual clarity, I think explains a lot. And of course, specific decisions like the Bias Kolchem one is one example. We talked about in our own shiurim this year. I mentioned Masa Grishaso and Sota and Kadesha and Nechos Ishos or Nechos Gerishin rather than Nechos Isfabia. And even what we just talked about the other day, which is, why does the Rambam sometimes speak about one issue in more than one place and seem to speak about them with different emphases, even if there isn't a stira? In some cases, there may even look like there is a stira. So again, my answer would be that he's trying to emphasize you know, a different component, and there's a reason why he does that in different contexts. Again, the miun issue of gemar, kiddushin, etc., is, I think, a very good example of that. And of course, again, certain omissions which otherwise would be problematic are explained the same way. Again, just to call upon the topics that we've been doing, Perek Aleph, Halacha Ches, in Ochasishus, not mentioning the Isra Asei of Yibum and mentioning the others is a great example. Or, you know, spill a little more ink and, you know, just mention it. You know, why give the, you know, Nosei Kalim, you know, the opportunity to attack you? I don't mean it literally. But the point is that there's a certain conceptual purity in telling it like it is. Sometimes people ask questions on the Rambam when he gives other, again, we know this from our Divrei Sofrim discussions, like why have a confused, seemingly complex posture? Or why quote other psukim when there are psukim that the Gemara quotes? Or, you know, in general, you know, why take these more difficult stands? In some cases, the Rambam has a formulation which, you know, seems unnecessary because he doesn't disagree, like with the Gemara, which says something, let's say, more basic. And then, too, sometimes also can't say, well, why does he need to say this? It's already covered by that. So, again, if the Rambam is a Sefer Halacha to reveal, you know, Dinim, or to, you know, to provide, you know, a framework for the performance of Dinim, which also certainly is, again, I don't want to detract from that, then these are much stronger questions. If he's interested in presenting all of Torah Shabbat Sav and Torah Shabbat Peh in a purist, conceptual, Talmud Torah value way, then even if he doesn't need to repeat a halakha or to add another rationale, but if it's true, it's true. So, you know, the truth of it makes it, you know, necessary. Even if the, you know, Gili Milsa of the Din wouldn't. And again, this explains, I think, a lot of phenomena on the Rambam. So what we were talking about the other day was, you know, I had made a mention to it, but I didn't elaborate on it, that, you know, people criticize the Rambam for calling his work Mishneh Torah, and some of them also were upset, not just with the presumption, let's say, from their point of view of using that term, but also for his claim that, you know, if you read, you know, his work, so then, you know, that's, you know, being Mamale, Kreso, Babasar, etc., and, you know, then you can move on, you know, to other things. And some people even understood that what the Rama meant was, like, you know, you have to be a good, God-fearing, you know, a performing Jew, and therefore you need these halachos in front of you. And, you know, the real action, the real focus is going to be, you know, the world of philosophy, especially the interface, you know, with Aristotelian philosophy. So, like, Mishneh Torah gets you, you know, through it. You know, so you'll know what to do. You won't, you know, make a mistake when it comes to your Erev Tavshilin. And, you know, everything else, you know, really could be focused on other things. But in light of what we're saying about the character of the Rambam, the ambition of the Rambam, the mental energy of the Rambam, all of these things are combined, and the structure of the Rambam, the organization, the decisions that he makes, again, for somebody who is so amazingly organized, you know, to be doing these things clearly, intentionally, we just have to figure out why, obviously belies that interpretation. Obviously, the level of intentionality in what the Rambam does here is just enormous. And on the contrary, it isn't primarily a Sefer Psak Halacha so that we won't make mistakes that he's providing us. He's also providing us with that, but by not updating and by expanding at the same time to call it Torah Kula, every din of Taros, Kachim, Zrayim, every Yerushalmi, etc., and by making the decisions, editorial, organizational, formulaic, that he does, essentially all of that is pointing to just an amazing, you know, ambition. It's a representation of Kol HaTorah Kula, and that is a prerequisite for doing anything else. And that, of course, is a whole different orientation. So I just wanted to clarify that. Tamar, the question? Go ahead.
Because in terms of, like, in the beginning of the year, we're talking about the Seder Mishnayos, the Nivamos, and so those.
Yeah.
And, like, we're showing the clear also, like, interested in why we have a certain Seder Mishnayos.
Right.
So does that same conceptual framework apply to Mishnayos and the Rambam sort of reordering it?
That's a very good question. I don't know whether there's an objective answer. I think the an easier, I guess, question to look at is whether or not the Rishonim or the Mefarshim understood that the Mishnayos had such a purpose.
Sometimes it's a great case where they clearly assume so.
Right.
Like in the years. Right.
Exactly. So I'm saying the Rishonim definitely understood. Now, again, in terms of, you know, invoking that particularly, so there were different types of answers that were given. Again, the Rambam himself clearly comes from that tradition, although...
But yet, I'm saying he himself puts Yibum Chalitza all the way at the end of Nashim.
Okay. I mean, again, I don't think that's a problem. That is a reorganization, in a way.
It's interesting that right. Even if you thought that there's conceptual meaning to Seder Mishnayos, which he does in Perish Mishnayos,
right. I mean, again, he's addressing these questions in his Hakdama to Perish Mishnayos. Now, in Hakdama, so not all the answers are so appealing, but some of them are in his Hakdama to Perish Mishnayos, and some of the other Rishonim are as well. I'm saying you can see from some of the answers that are given, and you'd have to go, you know, across the board, read all of the Meiri's suggestions, all of the Rambam suggestions, all of the Bali Tosa suggestions, to see whether or not, again, they're more pragmatic mnemonic, and they serve more the goal of Psak Halacha, or they are indeed, you know, more conceptual. The fact that the Rambam ends up, you know, explaining, let's say, the priority of Yibamos in one way, but choosing in Mishnah Torah still to structure it in the end, doesn't bother me at all. Because, again, I think there are two different issues. One is there intentionality and are you trying to express values? The other is this still the best way, right, to provide a framework of Kol HaTorah Kula? You might accomplish like a certain goal in a very striking way about highlighting a certain point in Yibum B'Chalitza by putting it in a certain order, but when you're writing a closed work and a reorganized work, which he is, I mean, he reorganizes all the time. So you're still, reading Rambam's Hilchos Ishus and the Rambam's Hilchos Geirushin with all of the nuances that we're describing, so then, you know, Yibum B'Chalitza really does go in the end. Because, you know, it's the, you know, culmination of it. You don't really need it to highlight, you know, the first halach on the Rambam, you know, already highlights it. And that's not in any Mishnah or any Gemara. Kodem Matan Torah, Aisha, Ish Pogea, Aisha Bishuk. And then following that up with Kadesha and saying Lisa Isha Biksuva Bikidushin and integrating Piri Varivia with Kidushin. Like all those things that he does in the very, very beginning of Sefer Nashim, right, already set the tone for what we were suggesting is highlighted. You know, or part of the things that we said were highlighted by Yibum. So for the Rambam, you know, in addition to other, you know, you're writing a code, so you can't, you know, you may not want to put the exceptional place first. But in addition to everything else, because he is already rewriting, reorganizing, restructuring, integrating, etc., so for him, there's no longer need, you know, to put Yibum B'Chalitza in the beginning, even to accomplish those purposes, because he's already done that, you know, by his total treatment. So if anything, I think it's a very good question, but I think it really highlights even more the intentionality and the thought of the Rambam.
And would we say the same thing for Hol Sfarim? Let's say Mishnayos is the opening, for the Rambam, Zeroyim is sandwiched somewhere in the middle.
Yeah, I do think so. I mean, that's why Zeroyim, yeah, absolutely. I think there has to be, again, I think there is some, you know, again, I don't want to dismiss completely just, you know, normal structure. I mean, there are all sorts of factors that go into organization. And definitely clarity, you know, even if it's not clarity of Psak Halacha, but it's clarity of the presentation of Kol HaTorah Kula, right, even that is going to dictate, in some cases, efficient, you know, kinds of choices. But in addition to that, I think, that the, you know, reorganizations, just as the reorganizations of Halacha, Sanhedrin we were talking about, right, Hilchos Ishus for sure, Hilchos Shabbos, Hilchos Nizkei Mamon, right? All these reorganizations accomplish a certain goal. So I think the between Svarim or the organization of the Svarim for sure as well. Now again, in Mor Nebuchim, the Rambam isn't so inspirational about all of this, as we know. But that's also typical. And again, I think he's speaking to a different audience, and whatever we can pull out of there is already like a net. You know, benefit. I'm not so disturbed about, you know, his not focusing on that. He has a different agenda there. He's speaking about philosophical, the interface of philosophy and emunah issues and so on. But I think in Mishnah Torah, you know, that's absolutely correct. And the organization within is also important. Okay, so that is something that I wanted just to add and to clarify. Now, what we've been doing is, again, we started the year with Metzilas Yesharim. We went to Ish HaLacha. We were supposed to get to Nefesh HaChayim. We didn't, really. But we started off with Olam HaZeh and Olam HaBa and Avodas Hashem and how that's reflected. From there we went to how Brisk in general relates to this world. And what I was suggesting was that the approach to Talmud Torah highlights as kind of the cause of Ashishi Machriya Beneim, which demonstrates how you spiritualize this world. And then from there, we began to talk about how the Hashkafas Olam is consistent with, or flows out of, or each is reciprocal to the Derech Halimud. And then to do that, we spent the last couple of months evaluating a little bit some of the contributions of Reb Chaim by contrast and by parallel to those who preceded him, to those of his generation, the transition within Reb Chaim, both the Beis Halevi and Reb Chaim's own works, the Shiurim, let's say, and Volozhin, and then of course to again to his contemporaries, which we didn't really do much of, a little bit to the people who came before him, who already were focusing more conceptually or on breaking down components, people like the Midrash Chinuch and Shagas Aryeh and so on, and Beis Halevi certainly. But what also needs to be done, certainly, which we didn't do, is to compare. We did a little bit, a few examples, Chablachrini, Nor Sameach, but there are really contemporaries, Nor Sameach, Rogachover, Rabbi Yosef Engel, what's going on with the Avnei Nezer, in the world of the Avnei Nezer, people like that. What we have been doing, though, is just taking some examples where we have either contrasting or parallel treatments and trying to highlight some of the major components. What would also need to be done, since we're nearing the end of the possibility of doing it this year, is to analyze in light of all of this also some of his critics, the Ridvaz, the Marcheshes in particular. I'd have to. I have some ideas about it, but I'm certainly not anywhere near well-versed enough in their works, but I have some suspicions. But also I think a very fascinating thing to do, as I mentioned, and I'm not going to be able to do it right now, is to analyze the impact on Talmidim, because Reb Chaim's revolution definitely impacted on the whole world of learning, and yet the impact wasn't to turn everybody into briskers, nonetheless, there was an impact of information and particular concepts which made their way into the mainstream of learning, and that in itself is very impactful. There was also the impact of an approach, even if you don't take all aspects of the approach, or even maybe the most unique aspects of it. But again, the emphasis on breaking down to components, on analysis as opposed to analogy, on seeing Shas once again, because sometimes it wasn't the first time, but it maybe was an accentuation which hadn't been for a while, as being primarily about issues and legal concepts. Especially, and in a conceptual rather than a more pragmatic way, some of these things were certainly adopted in addition to the actual specific doctrines. Less so, some of the more subtle and I think more defining characteristics, inner cohesiveness or inner coherence, the question of, again, halachic reality, chalosis, reconstruction, etc. So I think it's very fascinating to examine, what different Talmidim got, and of course, since Talmidim are Talmidim, and they, like to see themselves in the image of their Rebbeim, which is a good thing, and at the same time, they have other exposures and their own personality, and this isn't completely scientific. You can't say, oh, this Talmud got X and that Talmud got Y, and there's obviously a lot of overlap, but you can see patterns. So what you need to do is examine Reb Chaim Ozer, the Achiezer, Reb Chana Wasserman, Kovet Shurim, the ones that I think we're familiar with, and probably some I'm leaving out, Abris Zalman Meltzer, Eben Ha'azel, the Imre Moshe, the Afike Yam, Reb Shimon Shkop, the Chazon Yecheskel, a little bit. People, what did they learn from him? What did they pick up? The quotation of certain doctrines and their promulgation in the system, even if you don't, even if you're not wedded to the ideology or even the derech that produces them, that in itself is very fascinating. How do you use certain concepts when you're not using the derech, and what does that produce? Is a very fascinating question. And as I said before, or what you take from an analytical approach and a formalistic approach, which things do you take, which you don't? Again, you're not going to find a situation where somebody is unless they're doing it intentionally. In other words, if a Talmud says, "Oh, I like this part, I don't like that part," and he, is able to be so selective, then you might really have very sharp, lines drawn. Most people, that's not, it's impact, it's influence, and it's the authority of a Rebbe. So it's more a question of, who are their other influences? There'll be a lot of overlapping, but you'll still be able to see patterns, etc. A lot of factors come into play here. When was the exposure? Who are the other people, other Rebbeim? At what point did they, come under the orbit of influence of Reb Chaim, in which, his Volozhin years, his Brisk years, things of that sort. And to what extent are these other Talmidim themselves kind of developing their own derech, which is a factor, Reb Shimon Shkop, particularly. Again, my knowledge is quite limited, but I have, again, certain impressions of Chazon Ish, is not a Talmid, but somebody who was a critic, but again, somebody who kind of was developing also his own derech, or maybe his own derech was a non-derech in some respects. That's also something that should be looked at. These are all really, I think, very fascinating questions, and questions which can be analyzed and can be advanced. In a serious way. My general impression is that people like Eben Ezel and the Achi Ezer and Kovitch Yurim, while the focus is on, again, Chakiros and, the idea of, finding litmus tests and methods of isolating factors and forces, etc., as well as some of the actual doctrines of Reb Chaim, some of the contribution of Reb Chaim we know from his Talmidim, you have that. But again, you don't have so much the more ambitious and more singular aspects of the derech. That you do have, of course, in the the family members, Rav Belvel, Rav Moshe, the Rav, the Briskas in Yerushalayim today and here. And what's interesting there is to figure out what the differences are and whether there's been an advance or an expansion. Or on the contrary, some people are very critical of the children of Rav Belvel, arguing that they've taken the material and made it kind of canonical, in that it's very authoritative, whereas the whole greatness of Brisk was always its openness to Chiddush, to seeing things in a different way. Again, the Rav was completely. I would say completely, in certain things he was, but mostly a non-canonical. I guess about some of the Yesodos, the bigger Yesodos, he was certainly very committed, but certainly in applying it in a more specific way, to specific sugyas or rishonim, in the nuances, certainly was not canonical. They say that I've never spent time there. Actually, I've read some of the works. But they're very, very makbid to say over exactly, how Rav Belvel said it and the order and so on. That is a little bit quixotic. I always like to point to the end of the Brisker Agada. They tell you where to dance. If you're in dance. So that's already a little, interesting. But that aside, the actual, again, the tremendous expansion, in, especially in the areas of Kachim, just the fact that for a century, members of this family have just been learning Kachim again and again and again and unearthing, nuances, to go with the Yesodos and expand them, has been a tremendous accomplishment and an advancement in its own right, even if it's with a little bit more of a conservative, with a small c, orientation. Again, these are also interesting phenomena about how, in general, how ideas get pushed forward, and the relationship of conservatism and dynamism and innovation when it comes to these issues. And there's a lot to be said there as well. The Bircha Shmuel, in particular, constitutes, I guess, an interesting study, because aside from the actual family members, he certainly, perceived himself, exclusively almost as a Talmud of Reb Chaim, and as somebody who was, kulo, mushpa from him. And, the heavy, heavy use of terminology, the word chalos itself is just like, again, in Birchas Shmuel anyway, again, it's hard to know. There are other ksavim now that are out that are maybe a little different. It's a very hard to read Sefer, as we've discussed in the past. If you know what's being said, you can usually find it there, and then you can find it and also see the expansion beyond what you might have thought. And that's it's a very helpful Sefer. But it's so terminologically heavy, the halachic reality aspect of it, let's call it, and in its terminology is so strong, and much stronger than in the ksavim that we have of the actual family members. So that's an interesting phenomenon. And again, I haven't, I've picked it up, many times. And again, I have very strong impressions. I haven't ever, gone b'shita, through Birchas Shmuel. But I think Yevamos is actually a great kind of point of departure for this kind of thing, because you have it lends itself to a certain complexity, number one, and as we already know, and of course you have Rabbi Chanan Wasserman's Kovetz Ha'aros is his most important work by far. Everything he writes is good, but Kovetz Ha'aros is his masterpiece. And of course you have the shiurim of the Birchas Shmuel as well, and just the contrast in reading them is sharp, and both are talmidim of Rab Chaim, say, but different kind, of talmidim, and they overlap, I think, in their discussion of a lot of issues. Again, I haven't gone through either one. I picked each one up, certainly covered Saros more than Birchas Shmuel, but I've picked all of them up, and I've gone b'shita through none of them. But it's not difficult to do that, and I have not done it b'shita, just a question of time and a priority. But I think it would be very fascinating to do, and it wouldn't take much of an effort, having gone through the Dapim and continue to go through the Dapim, if somebody wanted to study them and appreciate just a little bit of a different, some of the overlaps and some of the differences too. I was just looking at the it inspired me for the sugya that we're about to do tomorrow, the sugya of Tzaras Islandis. So this is, we've talked about this Reb Chaim all year long, Reb Chaim's view about, whether Eishes Ach can be an Erva, L'inyan Tzaras Erva, and the difference between, the consequence, of being Eishes Ach. But, there being an initial Nefila, it's Erva, so then maybe it's also Eishes Ach. Would that Eishes Ach, be an erva legabe tzaras erva, and or fundamentally there is Eishes Ach and there never was, a heter or chiyuv yibum. So in this, the Birchas Shmuel and Simon Hey talks about this to explain the Yerushalmi and the Ramban, that we're going to discuss tomorrow. So maybe we'll speak about it a little bit, tomorrow. So actually, there it's not as heavily terminologically laden as some of the other pieces are, but the point is that it's just interesting again in assessing the impact on Talmidim, and it's not, I'm not interested in this from a historical point of view mostly. I'm interested in this, in terms of the corpus of Torah Shebaal Peh and the development of Darkei HaLimud. It's a historically interesting issue, both of the phenomenon and per se, but we're also more interested in it than that, simply l'agdol Torah l'adira, because we learn from our Rabbeim and we learn from our textual Rabbeim, and that includes the Bali Tosis and the Ramban and the Rambam and the Rimigash and the Ksos and the Vesivas, and it includes the Arsameach and Reb Chaim, and then it includes the Birchas Shmuel and the Kovetz Chaim. That's the greatness of Torah as we've discussed. It's the continuation. So it'd be an interesting thing to do, to take some of these sugyas where we have material, and the same thing could be done with, again, Rav Shimon Shkop, which I think is a different, as they say in the yeshiva world, a different schnitt. It's like a different it's Rav Chaim influenced, and he was a Talmud, and yet he has a bit of his own derech, and more of a, I guess, external kind of philosophical approach. Certainly that was true contemporaneously to Rav Chaim of the Rogatchover as well. So these are some of the things that need to be done in order to go forward with this. I'm sorry this took so long, but let me just mention, there were two other sugyas that I wanted to mention very quickly, because I think they highlighted very dramatically the things that we were doing. I just wanted to speak about these other things because I wanted to just put in context what we've been doing, and to try to explain what I think is a program going forward to understand even better and appreciate better some of these perspectives on Darkei HaLimud. I also think, just before I mention one other thing, that that just as we got into this, that's one of the points I wanted to make as well, we got into this through Hashkafas HaChaim, right, and how, it's always better, obviously, when one's Derech HaLimud, in Halacha, dovetails with one's Hashkafas HaChaim. It doesn't always happen in the world of Hashkafa and Halacha, but it obviously is a very appealing thing. That's really one of the most important contributions to Jewish thought and to Halacha that the Rav made, was to highlight the integration of that. So it's also interesting. We've been talking about Brisk and its perspective on Shachas, Yofa Shachas Bolam Hazeh, its understanding of that Mishnah, and the Isha Halacha's perspective on reality and the opportunities of the physical world. And from there, we got into, how does that express itself in their view towards Halacha and, by extension, Derech HaLimud. So just also interesting always to raise the question, if we're talking about, the comparisons and the parallels and the overlaps and the contrasts, whether it's of predecessors, contemporaries, or Talmidim, right, to look, what impact, does that have hashkafically, on their worldview, on the way they look at Olam Hazeh and Olam Haba, and not just that, the relationship obviously between Lilmod and Lasos, and what the nature of Lilmod is and what the nature of Lasos is, and the relationship between Halacha and Hashkafa, the relationship between Musar and Halacha. So just as we've been charting just one, it's dear to my heart and I know it better, so that's what we've been focusing on. But I think that the broader issues and questions, which start off with analyzing, I think, the nitty-gritty, always. You can't, you can't and you should never want to, and either way, you won't get away with ignoring, the work and the actual steps. What does the Gemara say? What's, what are the developments, based on the earlier sources, what's different about this, et cetera, et cetera. But having done that, taking it a step further and trying to figure out what some of the meta issues or perspective on meta issues are, and the interrelationship between some of the meta issues, is also part of Talmud Torah and a study of Hashkafa as well. So as I alluded, Rav Shimon Shkop has seemingly like a little bit of a different perspective. I think the Chazon Ish has just a little bit of a different perspective on the whole concept of there being a Derech HaLimud, or that, Halacha is based on fixed, concepts and principles, etc. And I think he believes, Beshita, that, there's much more fluidity and much more, there's much more that's amorphous, that isn't, theoretical physics and mathematics. That's a bad paradigm, not just because he might not have wanted to use it, but it's just not the way he views, halachic discussion, and so on. So I think how that reflects in terms of how you see some of these interrelationships and meta issues, etc., is a very fascinating question and something which, you know, needs to be discussed in each and every case. The two topics that I still wanted to discuss, there are many more, obviously, but the two that I mentioned, so I don't know if we'll have an opportunity, but the next time we do have an opportunity, I still feel like I owe this, even if we don't, even if we were, you know, decide to do other topics going forward, is Rubo Kikulo and the topic of Shtaros versus Mepiyim Velo Mepiksavim. So just to mention what they are, and then, you know, so at least it'll establish that I'm like semi-sincere about doing them. The Mepiyim Velo Mepiksavim, as I mentioned, and Shtar is a very good example where the same material, where the same issue, same problem, in other words, and the same material is used by the Nesivas, and then later by Reb Chaim, right, with the same even solution, but a completely opposite perspective on the topic, and one which I think is very symptomatic of Reb Chaim's contribution. That's something I mentioned in the past. The Rubo Kikulo, if anybody wants to look into it already, is a famous piece that we have in the stencils about why it is that we say Azlina Basarov in the case of Dayanim, even though we normally say Ein Hochem B'mamon Achar Rov. This is, of course, based on an understanding of Tosis and Bava Kamma Daf Chav Zayin. Right? How do you understand that, you know, that particular din? And here I just wanted to contrast it because Reb Chaim has a very nuanced approach, very famous approach, where he distinguishes between Rubo Kikulo and the Biror of Stekos of Azlinam Basarov. He makes that distinction. But in his nuanced discussion of how what these, is there a relationship, are these two different dinim? Do they overlap in any way? If so, how do they overlap? I think number one, his discussion is very characteristic, both of his chiddush and also a little bit of his reticence to take it a step further, which, you know, I would have liked to see. But also, just when you compare it to the discussion in the Chiddush HaSfekos, it's klal vav, especially os, base and gimel, where the, you know, the Nesivus's brother, the Ksos's brother in the Chiddush HaSfekos, quotes the Maram Ibn Chaviv, and so on. He quotes the Sama Achronim. So the two different perspectives that he, you know, projects in to solve this problem are both overlap Reb Chaim's treatment, but again in ways that really highlight the difference. In two senses. Number one, each one, how each one is understood. In other words, Reb Moshe Ibn Chaviv's equivalent to Rubo Kikulo is very different than Reb Chaim's. Even though it's easily mistaken one for the other, and it accomplishes the same goal, but it's just quite different in a characteristic way. The other one, which is about Koach Bezdin, right, in Dinei Mamonis, that's the other, you know, factor, again, is something which the Kuntus HaSfekos himself likes to answer this question and sees as an opposite answer of Maram Ibn Chaviv. What's interesting is that Reb Chaim relates to that aspect of it also, but in a way that integrates with his Rubo Kikulo. So, Od Chazon HaMoed, so I wanted to, you know, even before we move on to other things, again, we could try to do some of this other program, but at least in terms of this Chativa Shlema, I at least want to highlight with these two other examples the next time we get a chance. I'll have to figure out when that is. Okay, so I was going to speak about the details, but I'm not going to keep you for it.